Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And welcome again to another episode of Lost in Science. We've got 30 sweet, sweet minutes now to talk about some science content that has tickled our brains over the last week. My name's Lyndon and I'm joined today by Claire. G'day, Claire.
Hello,
how's your brain?
Lyndon.
Is it feeling tickled?
Well, my brain is feeling tickled in all sorts of ways. And that is a direct reference to the story I'm talking about today.
Get out of town. Are you serious? You're talking about tickling? You're talking about brain tickling?
I'm talking about brain reorganization. Oh. And specifically the brain reorganization that happens when you get pregnant.
Topical.
Because as you know, and dear listeners, maybe... You know, this is the time to tell you. I'm up the duff again. Second pregnancy, baby.
You heard it here first.
And you know, when you get pregnant, people talk a lot about baby brain. However, there has been some fascinating research that's come out both this year and last year, sort of refocusing what baby brain is and how and what pregnancy does to a mother's brain. And I'm not just talking like short-term forgetting stuff. I'm talking long-term changes to the brain over time. And the fascinating thing is that I really want to talk to you about, Lyndon, is that the changes don't just happen after the first pregnancy, but then there's a whole suite of different changes that happen after the second pregnancy.
Wow.
I know. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today. A little bit of brain tickling, a little bit of reorganization, a little bit of bear with me because I might have a little bit of that going on right now.
So this is an autobiographical like exploration of a topic
it
that
is.
You're going to explore. You've
it
basically
is.
Gone, which tabs are already open?
Mate, this might be. This might be my brain's swan song. But anyway, how about you? What's been tickling your brain this week?
What's been tickling my brain this week coming into school holidays, if you're not up the duff,
if you
celebrate school holidays, if they're a part of your calendar, then maybe you have in your house one of the scientists' most favourite vegetables. It's coming into season now. And I thought today we could talk about a couple of kitchen science experiments that you could do.
Oh.
With the humble cabbage.
Oh, cabbage.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Friend of the new mother as well. Cabbage is famously helpful for cooling boobs.
Mastitis.
Yep. Oh, yep. Helping out boobies. So maybe if you've got children that are slightly older and you're looking for some fun science experiments to do, or maybe... if, like my good self, you've got a sad old-looking cabbage in the back of the fridge.
I do.
Hold on to your hats because I've got some ideas for you this week. Shall we crack on with it?
Let's go. Lyndon, as I said in the intro, I am preggers with my it's my second time around going for a second time. Yeah, thank you. But don't you reckon it just never ceases to amaze me? There's some very obvious ways that the human body is affected when it's pregnant. You know, the organs shift, there's extra blood, get the sore back, there's the nausea, there's the heartburn. And there's
and the belly. Don't forget, like, the oh belly yes, bit.
How could I forget? Yeah, but then there's some less obvious results of pregnancy. Like, I was very surprised when I found out a pregnant friend had to change her glasses prescription, had to actually change her glasses when she fell pregnant. So, yeah, that's just one. And we could be here all day sort of talking through what some of those, you know, crazy side effects are.
Different foot size, you know, people going up and down a couple of foot sizes when they're pregnant, sometimes getting their feet back, sometimes their feet have changed size forever after having kids.
But one change that gets bandied around a lot is the onset of baby brain when you're pregnant. You know, this is sort of like the scatterbrain. Can't remember anything. That's sort of like fog that descends on women when we're pregnant and sticks around once your baby is born, just to be mixed in with some lack of sleep and the rest of it. But today I want to talk about a couple of research papers that have been published in Nature recently, and they sort of just flip the narrative of the baby brain around. So it's not a fog, but really they have looked into it, and actually it's a hugely important and necessary rewiring of the brain. In fact, it's the brain, you know, that they suppose might actually undergo the biggest change as a result of pregnancy and birth, and something that, just like the feet, might not ever go back to how it was. And, you know, I think that's a pretty big call, because, like, try telling that to my other organs that are changing at the moment, but it's the brain that's undergoing the biggest change. But, hey, let's stick with it for a while. So the first paper I want to talk about, it was published in Nature in January 2025. It's called "Pregnancy Entails a U-Shaped Trajectory in Human Brain Structure Linked to Hormones and Maternal Attachment." So imagine a U, and on the x-axis is time, and on the y-axis is gray matter content.
Okay.
And that is what they're referring to as a U-shaped trajectory.
Hang on. So what's the end of the x-axis? Is it death or is it the birth of the
baby? Oh, it's when they stopped measuring the mothers.
And when did they stop measuring the mothers? Tell me about the method. What does this mean?
Okay. So the researchers from Spain and Netherlands, so they conducted it was actually the largest longitudinal brain study of pregnancy to date. So it was 127 first-time mothers. And it's notoriously difficult to get ethics approval to do sort of longitudinal studies and also, you know, MRIs and brain scans on mothers. But each participant in this study, they had 5 brain scans. So there was one before conception, there was twice during pregnancy, and then one at 1 month postpartum, once the baby had been born, and one 6 months after the birth.
Okay. So the end of the U is 6 months after the birth.
The end of the U is 6 months here, yeah.
I'm a bit obsessed with this U. Obsessed with you, Claire. You know that.
Yeah. You obsessed. They also measured hormone levels, so estrogen, alongside the brain imaging. And as a comparison group, they also studied new parents in same-sex relationships who did not experience pregnancy. So, and then as well as that, they studied as a control women without children. So they were really looking at whether the effects were looking after the baby and being a parent behaviorally, or whether it was actually the biology of it.
Oh, that's such a clever design to consider.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Is it the actual sleeplessness and complete explosion of your life as you knew it before, is that affecting your brain, or is it actually the biology that's going on? Oh, that's fascinating. Okay, so what did they find? What does the U mean?
So the U means that in first-time mothers, there was this decrease in gray matter. So gray matter in the brain is, you know, it's the stuff you need to think. and to be yourself. It's densely packed neurons, and it decreased by around 5%, which is not nothing. It's quite a substantial amount. And they found this in key brain regions. So these brain regions, they're called the default mode and the frontoparietal network. But for those of us playing at home, these are areas that are linked to things like emotion, empathy, and social perception. So these brain changes peak just before birth. And then after birth, the brain volume begins to recover. It gets to about 3.4% recovery by the 6 months postpartum, but they did not see a full recovery afterwards.
Oh, so it's not actually a full U. It's more like a backwards J.
It is. It is a bit like a backwards J. Exactly.
Okay.
I'll have more to say on that in a second, but what I did want to say is these changes were consistent across all women and seen across a lot of the brain surface. And there's also a really strong link to hormones. So as estrogen increased, gray matter decreased. And then as estrogen dropped after birth, you saw a recovery in gray matter. Well, this sort of like partial recovery of gray matter. And the changes didn't occur in the non-pregnant co-parents, the comparison that they were making. So it did show that the effects are driven by the biology, not just becoming a parent.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so this was sort of pretty mind-blowing. It presents the clearest evidence yet that pregnancy reshapes the brain and continues to reshape the brain, and that this brain reshaping, it's our brain actually becoming rewired to support caregiving. It's what neuroscientists liken to synapses being pruned to become more efficient. So you can see this as like strengthening certain pathways in your emotional and empathetic and social, I guess, like armor and capability rather than, and like to be able to care for a new person.
Wow. I've heard that idea of creating stronger pathways and stronger sort of synapse relationships in the brain in relation to anxiety. And I wonder if a similar study was done on first-time parents who had postnatal anxiety versus first-time parents who didn't, what they would see in the brain there, whether there's a greater amount of pruning or a strengthening of particular pathways that are in the area of the, you know, the threat response area of the brain or something like that. So that's where they saw the when you say that the gray matter recovered most of the way, was it in the same areas where it had been lost, or was it mainly in those zones to connect with emotional sort of attachment, those kinds of things?
They didn't go into a great deal of detail around where the 3.4% recovered from. But what they did go into was you could still detect via brain scan 90% certainty that a woman had a baby years later. Just by the doing the brain scan. So it's a marker that's ongoing. So these changes are incredibly long lasting. So the same research group actually, and this is where we come back to the J, they had published another study that showed that the changes were detectable up to 6 years later and were actually a predictor of how warmly mothers related to their children.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a big one. That's a big statement to say, I'm going to scan your brain and tell you how much you connect with your child.
Well, I don't know if it was that way round necessarily, or it was they were asking the mothers how they connect to their children, and then they were doing the scans.
And they found
that correlation.
They found the size of the J. You can tell I've really clung on to this. graph, the size of the uptick was larger for women who felt that they had stronger connections with their children.
I think that's what they were getting at. But, I mean, we're talking about a couple of research papers here in this incredibly, you know, complicated brain science. Yeah. So obviously we need to do more work on this, right, to understand exactly what's going on. But I think what's a good step forward is having an understanding of and sort of like a foundational understanding of how a mother's brain does adapt to parenting. And it can also, I think, then lead to more questions around how you can support women. Because, I mean, 1 in 5 women are affected by postnatal depression, right? So, you know, being able to use this neuroscience to then support more vulnerable women and developing more resilient sort of ways to support women through that time, just knowing what massive changes our brains are going through.
For sure. You also mentioned some science around what happens to the brain second time round.
Do
I want to hear that? What sort of letter would you ascribe to that particular study?
I think it might be you again, but they don't.
I thought you were going to say F.
Fail. They don't put it in the article name. It was published in February this year in Nature again, and it's called The Effects of a Second Pregnancy on Women's Brain Structure and Function.
Is this from the same team?
They're not the same researchers, but they have worked in this area before. So anyway, they did 3 MRI scans before pregnancy, and they looked at women with their first having the first child, women having their second. And as we said, with the first pregnancies, there were the big changes in the brain with the pruning and the sort of like honing in on self-awareness and understanding and empathy. But in the second pregnancies, those areas were already sort of, they'd already changed. So there was less change happening there. But what they did see is bigger changes in areas that are responsible for attention and responsiveness to the outside world and like task focused networks. Like what they can conclude pretty much from that is this is your brain rewiring itself to reflect the demands of parenting one child while preparing for another. So being able to manage 2 children in a world where you've only had to think of one.
Wow. Wow. I have 2 thoughts on this at exactly the same time. The first one is superheroes. I can't believe 50% of the population, if they are able to and if they so choose to, can be superheroes who have got brains that change.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah.
But the second thought I have is that, and this is quite a cynical thought, to imagine that some people could weaponize this kind of study and go, see, look, women are just supposed to be doing this kind of work. It's women are, look, you're literally, your brain's changing to be able to fit in all this extra stuff. So women are the ones that are supposed to stay home and do that extra stuff. Did the researchers touch on that at all?
They did not touch on that at all. Interesting. Yep. They didn't touch on that. It stuck pretty closely to the neuroscience. I think I'd take a more glass half full look at it, Linda. And as I said before, I'm just like, I'm flabbergasted that it is 2026 and we're just finding out about these major, major brain developments that happen to pregnant people. You know, I am heading into my 3rd trimester with a 2nd pregnancy. I mean, it is, I think, reassuring to me to know that my brain is working on a little bit of that behind the scenes and that there's a little bit of support there. But also, as we all know, there's only so much pruning that your brain's going to do.
And you're totally right in that. Like, this is one layer of a really complicated field. You know, brain science is complicated enough by really complicated field, I mean parenting is a very complicated field. There's a lot of other factors at play there in terms of existing personalities of yourself and your partner if you have one and your existing child if you're heading into your second pregnancy and the environment that you're in and the history that you grew up in, the cultures that you have there's so many other factors at play. I can see why knowing that coming into your third trimester would be comforting to when you think, oh, I've got brain fog, I've got baby brain. No, my brain's just busy. It's doing stuff back there.
Yeah.
Getting me ready for the next bit.
That's right. Getting me ready for the big U.
May it be a U for you and not a little backwards.
In the history of science, novel and innovative concepts occasionally arise from sudden left field inspiration.
Nothing shocks me. I'm a scientist.
But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science.
I think they're scientists.
I bring scientists. You bring a rock star.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lost in Science. And to finish off the show today, I wanted to talk about some kitchen science. You know I love a bit of kitchen science, Claire, and I know you do
so
as well.
Good.
And I wanted to talk about this partially because I did this in my kitchen last month and it was really fun and I kind of wanted to share it.
That's the best reason, Lyndon.
And this is an activity that you can do with the humble cabbage. The humble cabbage is coming into season now. I think they start... You know, over the cooler months, you can start harvesting cabbages. It doesn't matter, red cabbage, white cabbage, wombok, all the lovely variants of cabbage. This particular experiment, maybe you've done it before, Claire. Have you ever made a pH test liquid out of cabbage? Have you ever done that?
You know, I've never actually boiled the cabbage. I've only, like, scabbed somebody else's boiled cabbage and done the experiment. I've never actually done the boiling.
It's pretty fun. Of the cabbage, it's a bit...
Which is a shameful thing to say.
Get out of here. Look, I'd never done it before either until very recently, but I was just full of joy at the result of the experiment.
Yes. Talk a little us bit through
stinky,
it.
A little bit stinky, but okay. So this is a way that you can make your own pH indicator using a red cabbage, okay. Purple cabbage.
Okay. So an indicator to tell you if something is acidic.
Alkaline or acidic. That's right. And red cabbage is quite helpful because it gets its colour from these compounds in the leaves that are called anthocyanins. They're called anthocyanins, and these anthocyanins, they are very pH sensitive, so they change their structure, their chemical structure very slightly, depending on the like aqueous substance, depending on the liquid that they're in. So what you do, get some red cabbage leaves. Cut a few of them up. I'm sorry, you actually don't even need to use the whole cabbage. Go ahead if you've got one that you really just want to get rid of. You've made as much coleslaw as you can possibly handle. But chop up some cabbage, put it in some water, boil it for a few minutes until the water's really dark, that dark purple color. Take the leaves out, so strain the water out and let the water cool. Then you can use it as an indicator.
Right.
Which means, here's the fun begins, you can basically make... a rainbow, and you can watch this water, the indicator change colour, depending on how acidic or how alkaline something is.
So what are some things that you tested? How did you know? Did you just go around and, like, test things and then put them into a rainbow? Because that sort of sounds fun. Yeah,
yep. Great. Basically, okay. That's what we did. So we got as many glasses as we could, and we put a little bit of the purple indicator liquid in there, and we added some stuff. So the first thing that we tried was some baking some bicarb soda.
Ooh.
And that made the water go a little bit blue.
Mm.
And then we tried some vinegar, and that's quite acidic, and so that made the water go a little bit orangey yellow. And then I got really that excited and busted out some bleach. I did that, not my child. By this stage, I was like, get out of here. I'm doing some science.
Mum's got a science.
Mum's doing some science now. No, we all had a good time. You could try some lemon juice.
No one got bleached in the process.
No. It was all very safe. That was fine. But we tried lots of different things. We tried some dishwashing liquid. We tried some bleach, as I said. We tried, we could have tried some salt. I think that would have been good. And then we tried mixing them up. Apparently, you could also try tomato juice, just different levels of things that have different levels of acidity or alkalinus. And the more alkaline things will go blue, purpley, darkish black color. And the more acidic things will go red and orange and yellow and green.
Wow.
Yeah. So pure water, if you just added water to it, might change color a bit. So that was just the most fun. That's
magic.
The most fun. Yeah.
I mean, it's not magic, it's science, but
it's chemistry. Very cool.
Yeah.
It will be, if you just add water, it will be purple. That will be a pH of 7. Oh. And then more alkaline, the more acidic things will be red and pink, and then coming into purple. And the more alkaline things will be green and yellow and orange. So you can create a rainbow.
Wow, that is a full really rainbow,
cool.
Isn't it?
It's really cool. But maybe you're saying, oh, that sounds super fun, but I don't have a red cabbage. I've got a white cabbage.
I do.
Oh, you've got a white cabbage right now.
Yeah, and it's really moldy. But you just take off a couple of leaves and I reckon she'll be good under there.
Excellent. Okay, well, here's a different way you can make a rainbow with a white cabbage. Get rid of the moldy ones. Get a few of the ones that are underneath. Get a few glasses and some food dye. Put a few of the colours in different glasses. And try some capillary action experiments.
Oh.
Yeah. So you know that capillary action is how our plants and trees kind of drink. And this occurs capillary action. For the longest time, I always thought it was capillary reaction. Happens because water is sticky, right? Thanks to the fact that the water molecules like to stay close together. That's called cohesion. And the water molecules are also attracted to other substances and stick to other substances, right? If you think of dipping paper towel in some water, the water will kind of climb up the paper towel. And that's the water molecules being attracted to the paper towel until it gets, gravity kind of gets the better of it and it has to stop. And that's also why, you know, the smaller and smaller a glass tube will be, the higher and higher the water can go because the surface tension at the top kind of and the stickiness to the sides of the glass tube allows the water to move higher and higher and higher. It's exactly the same with plants. And you can see it beautifully with white or green cabbage. So get some of those leaves that aren't quite so moldy, but they can be pretty sad. Get some glasses, put some different colours in those glasses, and then put a leaf in each glass. Leave it for 2 to 24 hours.
Okay.
And you can make yourself a cabbage rainbow.
Cabbage rainbow. Yeah. Yes.
You'll probably even eat it. So don't despair if you have neglected a cabbage. You were just waiting for the right time to do some science. So have a play these school holidays. And enjoy. Let us know how it goes.
Wham! Rebop! Boom! Bam! I can sing and I can jam. Wham! Rebop!
And that's all we have time for on this episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at lostinsight@gmail.com or just listen again next week when Lyndon, Claire, Chris and Stu get lost in science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.